activate the view screen, and turn on your universal translators, because it is time for another Galactic Netcast.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Wednesday, the 30th of April, 2014. Welcome to another Galactic Netcast. This is the Alien Invasion number 103 in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I'm Dave Nelson. Joining me as always is Brad Ludwig from Wausau, Wisconsin. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Dave.
How's it going?
Rainy. Very rainy here. Check local listings.
Yeah.
And at least the nice thing about it is, one, it's not snowing.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Wisconsin, that could happen up until July. and two, it's actually starting to make things green up a bit. So it's a mixed bag blessing, but we'll take it.
We were talking about the exact same thing today, because I was like, I'm sick of this rain, because it's been like monsoon here too. It's nonstop rain. But then the grass is greening up. I'm like, well, I guess without all the rain, we won't have all this green. So, you know.
You try to find the silver lining where you can.
Yeah, exactly. So, do you want to explain where Anessa is this week? I know people who listened last episode will know, but there might be some out there that didn't listen.
She's actually in Morocco. She is a secret agent.
Oh, I knew it.
Oh, I'm not allowed to talk about that. I'm sorry. The official story is that she's packing to move. And she is moving to Wisconsin to live with me.
Yay.
Yeah, so she's got a lot of stuff to put in boxes and get ready to go. So she's taking a couple more, like this one and one more.
I think she talked 3 weeks last week.
So but she will be back soon enough, joining in on the shenanigans. That would be for our May 14th show?
Okay. Yeah, that would be right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get my wife, Stephanie, on for next week and maybe the week after as well. So,
cool.
Yeah. Looking forward to that. All right. This is the podcast where we talk about beings from elsewhere in the universe and their appearances in film, TV, video games, comic books, science, and in real life. The show is divided into three sections: the news, the craft corner, brand new feature, that's the spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft, and our picks for the week. If you want to watch us live, we do record the show Wednesdays. If you want to know what time exactly and where to go, just follow us on Galactic Netcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Google Plus, and you'll get notified in your timeline or whatever. You can click the link and find us and watch us and that kind of thing. All right, so before we get into the actual show, I want to give everybody a heads up about our brand new thing that we are doing. It is our Patreon campaign, and it's really a neat way to kind of invest in what we're doing and help Galactic Netcast become the leading provider of science fiction, science, and geek culture content on the internet, damn it. And all you got to do is give as little as $1 a month. $1. That's it. And you become our boss. You know, it's an investment that you make in us because you like us so much that you're willing to do that. I mean, a dollar a month. What would a dollar a month? If you gave a dollar a month every month, Brad, mm-hmm. What would you have to sacrifice in your life?
3 packets of ramen.
That's it. $1's nothing, you know. One less soda / pop.
Yep.
A month. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not much of a sacrifice unless you make no money. Unless you're like living in a van down by the river, then living in a van down by the river.
See, I need to be wearing a coat. I'm wearing the shirt and the tie, but I'm not wearing a coat to really sell that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we just started this week. Go to the following URL. It's Patreon, patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. Again, patreon.com/galacticnetcasts. And we have a link on our website as well, galacticnetcasts.com. Our first goal is to make $500 a month, and that will bring back our very first podcast that we had so long ago. This is before the alien invasion. I had the very first podcast. It was called the Sci-Fi Daily and was basically like a minute and a half sci-fi news update every day. We'll do it maybe three times a week, something like that. But that is the first goal, to raise $500 a month, and you guys are the ones that are going to do it. Become our boss for as little as a dollar a month. Work for us at patreon.com/galacticnetcast, and we thank you in advance for making this network even better than it is now. You ready? Start the show?
Let's do this thing.
All right.
In the news.
And I do believe Mr. Brad Ludwig has the very first story.
I do. New evidence reveals what a typical solar system looks like. Now, I'm trying to remember where this story came from because, it was from Io9. Io9 put together this really amazing story. And here we go. Prior to the discovery of exoplanets, astronomers assumed that our solar system's configuration was typical. But now that we have close to 2,000 exoplanets that we found, we're actually not the norm, not even close. And here's what astronomers found. This astronomer, Eric B. Ford, says, I think it's fair to say that most astronomers assume that our solar system was unlikely to be an anomaly. Now, they've been looking at this. He works for astronomy and astrophysics in Pennsylvania State University, in State College, Pennsylvania. What a great name for a city.
Let me guess. Let me guess. There's a college or a university there, right?
Yeah, Pennsylvania State University is there, so they called it State College.
Why not?
Why not? But it's a very apt and very good description of the of the city.
Why beat around the bush?
So this made perfect sense at the time, given the lack of the ephemeral evidence to suggest otherwise. It was a valid application of the Copernican principle, i.e. we shouldn't assume that we're strange in the large scheme of things. But as Ford points out in the paper that he put together, called from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, we now know that our solar system is atypical in multiple ways. Let's see.
So, okay, let me put it in layman's terms real quick. So, our solar system is basically one giant circle with a bunch of circles, inside circles, right?
Ellipses, but yeah.
Yeah. So that's not typical, turns out.
Well, yeah, I guess for lack of a better term. I mean, we're, let's see.
We have one star, and it's elliptical orbits, a bunch of planets around the one star. That's our solar system, and we thought that was typical for a long time, but that's not so.
Not exactly. Like, we've, got things hot Jupiters. Like, there's other planets that can exist that actually give off heat that are the size of, you know, our size of Jupiter.
Okay.
You know, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing all over the place, and this report is really kind of
I can totally see how if our solar system the way it's laid out now, our solar system, if Jupiter was a hot Jupiter, that could actually make another habitable zone, right? Further out in the solar system.
So, like here, one of the first planetary models to emerge was one featuring a giant planet orbiting very close to its host star, a so-called hot Jupiter. These systems typically feature a gap between the gas giant and any additional planets further away from the host star. Hot Jupiters feature orbital periods of up to several days and masses comparable to that of Jupiter or Saturn. And they are, you know, just like our Jupiter is kind of a failed sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could have, had the conditions been right, we could have had a binary solar system, binary suns. But in this particular case, if you have a hot Jupiter, like how it forms, the working theory is that they begin as a rocky core far away from the host star, and followed by the accretion of a gaseous envelope. So basically, it's this core gathers some of the gas in the area that it's orbiting. And then it migrates to an uncomfortably close orbital location, sometimes as close as 2 to 5 orbital periods. 2 to 5 day orbital periods, like going around the host star, like an orbit would be every 2 to 5 days.
That's a fast orbit.
Yeah, because like Mercury is about, God, I want to say 14, but I don't think that that's right. I don't even think that's close to right.
I thought Mercury's orbit was like longer than the Earth year.
That's
what I thought.
Oh, not the element. I want the planet. 88 days. I'm sorry. It takes 88 days for Mercury to go. Even though Mercury is the closest planet to the sun, it takes 88 days. So imagine having something the size of Jupiter going around our sun every 2 to 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, that could potentially become a binary star, but it did not actually happen. Let's see. Astronomers are also discovering giant planets with orbital distance ranging from as few as one to several astronomical units, or AUs. So,
what is that? What is that equal to?
Oh, God, I used to know.
I'm really making you do a lot of Googling, aren't I?
No, I'm kind of ashamed because usually this week has just kind of been rushed, and I usually do more prep than this, and I'm kind of ashamed. Okay, an astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the sun.
Okay.
As a unit of measurement.
So some solar systems, the closest planet in that system is one AU. So there wouldn't be any planets between us and the star at the center.
Yeah.
Okay.
These wide eccentric orbits suggest that some of these planets have ejected others from the host planetary system.
Wow.
And in fact, studies have shown that this planet scattering effect can naturally produce a broad range of eccentric orbits observed by astronomers.
So basically, our solar system is really boring, it sounds like.
For the most part, I mean, I know if you actually look at, if you were to look at our solar system, like on a horizontal plane, like you were looking at it, like, you know, head on.
Mm-hmm.
From the side, so a side view, okay? I know some of our planet, I can't remember if it's Neptune or Uranus, that actually it's an ellipse, so it's a kind of a flattened circle, but it actually would dip down a little bit lower than the horizontal plane.
Gotcha.
Okay. So, I mean, we do have some peculiarities, but not to the level that we're seeing with some of these other exoplanets and the systems that they are in. So everything that we've thought as to what it takes to maybe have life, what it takes to make a solar system, is we're discovering is not exactly what we thought. We've gathered more data than we've ever had before, and now we can actually take a look at, okay, all we've known so far is our own solar system. And in our quest for trying to find life and what other solar systems have formed into, what we thought is the norm, what we've looked at is our own, it's not like that. No two solar systems are the same at all.
Do you ever think about what our solar system would have been like if Jupiter had turned into like a small star? I mean, there would have been the possibility for life further, you know, farther out into our solar system, right? Like there would be our habitable zone, with our planet, and then, you know, you couldn't, life couldn't exist beyond that. But then you get to Jupiter, right? And you get a new habitable zone with the possibility of life around those other planets closer to Jupiter. I find that possibility very interesting.
Yeah, what was it? Uh, 2010.
Yeah, yep. Yep, that's what happened at the end of that movie, spoiler alert.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, what was it? The final message was you can visit everything else but God, I want to say Titan.
Yeah, cuz that's where the obelisk is. Am I saying that right? Obelisk?
Obelisk.
Obelisk. Okay. The black bar that goes over that the black sensor bar. The upright black sensor bar. But just imagine, though, like, if you were to live in a different type of solar system with the possibility for life further out, that would be really interesting. Like, you would meet your neighbors.
It was at Titan's not even the right moon. It's a different moon orbiting a different planet. It was Europa.
Okay.
Was the one that they couldn't visit.
Okay.
That was the message from the obelisk.
There was an episode of Star Talk I listened to, and Neil deGrasse Tyson was answering a question similar to that, and he talked about how it is possible that we could ignite Jupiter and make it into a star if we had the right technology.
Yeah, we would have to add a significant amount of mass to it, though, if I recall correctly, to get it to fire up.
Yeah. I could just see, you know, the equivalent of two sticks, you know, rubbing together, trying to get that thing to go.
Wow. It kind of makes you wonder. Yeah, I keep thinking about that. If we had another sun in our solar system, what changes would have happened? Would we have actually, you look at it this way, Jupiter and, I believe it's Jupiter and Saturn are blocking planets for us, essentially. Anything that orbits or incoming debris or whatever tends to get knocked aside or knocked out of kilter and away from us for the most part.
Yep.
But if we had another sun, something that would be, I mean, it would be even denser than Jupiter. I mean, like I said, we'd have to add a lot of mass to it. What changes would happen?
Would life
orbits of other planets would probably shift too? I mean, there would probably be, if we were to fire something up on Jupiter, if we were to somehow come up with the technology to make it into a sun, how devastating would it be to the way our solar system is right now?
Yeah. Not to mention, we wouldn't have as much, we'd have more daylight, less darkness, right? Probably.
Yeah, we'd probably get the double sunrise, like the classic shot of Tatooine on A New Hope.
Yeah.
With Luke Skywalker.
It's interesting to think about. All right. Anything,
crazy stuff.
Anything in that story, like, really weird? Like, they give an example of really strange solar systems? I know there's dual star systems. I mean, there's multiple suns sometimes.
Yeah, So he even talks about its implications for life, possibly, and changing, you know, the search for alien life. Now that we understand that solar systems are not necessarily light Earth-like or our solar system-like, Ford goes on to say the history of how planets formed can have a significant impact on their habitability. For example, most of Earth's original water may have been lost to space. In that case, much of Earth's present-day water may have been acquired by collisions with asteroids and comets. The rate those collisions depend on the locations, blah, blah, blah. His paper thus proposes some interesting questions, such as, is it worth searching for signs of life on planets larger than Earth and likely enshrouded in a dense atmosphere? If so, what would we look for? Also, if we don't find any evidence of life, would that be a meaningful finding? So is the absence of evidence informative? Is that telling? Or would our search be so primitive that it's not really an interesting result? So we've come a long way. We've found, you know, in the past few years, we've found, you know, over 715 extrasolar planets. But are we still at the point where we don't have the ability to gather the right data? We're gathering data.
Mm-hmm.
We have more knowledge, but are we gathering the right knowledge? Do we know enough about exoplanets, about solar systems, to definitively say that this planet does or does not show signs of having life on it?
And are we wasting time? Like,
yeah.
Why do we want to look for life? Because there's no real possibility of going there, right?
For the most part. I mean, at best, we would be able to, from a very, very long distance, even if we shot a probe out there, I mean, there's a star that we found, for example, kind of slightly off topic, but not really. There's a cold star that we found. I saw this in the news. And it's actually, the temperature is below freezing. It's a brown dwarf, and it's 7.2 light years away. So in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty close. But even if we shot a probe out there, it would take, I couldn't even give a number because I don't know how fast we can get something out there.
Yeah,
but it would take longer than our lifetime.
Yeah, the only way that we're going to get to another solar system is learn how to either fold or warp space. Those are the only choices. Or if we find a wormhole nearby that just happens to come out near another system with life.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool. Great discussion, Brad. Awesome story.
There's a lot of things going on with this. It does relate to aliens and alien life in a roundabout way, insofar as, kind of, this also is like a mirror to us. Are we, we've been looking at everything from a certain point of view. That's our solar system. Has that been the right way to go? And we're definitely finding that that's not the case, even remotely.
And we'll have the link to the story in the show notes of the podcast and at galacticnetcasts.com. IO9 is a treasure trove of great stories. We get a lot of content from that website. And thank you, IO9.com, for providing that stuff.
Yeah, and the nice thing about IO9 is they have separate sections for entertainment, but they do have the science section that is phenomenal, and mm-hmm. that's where a lot of the stories come from. We do have the occasional entertainment story, but a lot of the hard science stuff that we talk about comes from the science section of IO9. So.
Definitely. Another great site is blastr.com, BLASTR.com. That's where I get the next story from. And it's blatant science fiction. Things alien fans need to know about Alien Isolation. Have you heard about this? It's the next game in the Alien universe. The questions I have for you, sir, do you love the 1979 movie Alien, directed by Ridley Scott?
I think I love it more than Aliens, the second Aliens film.
Well, you're in luck. One more question. I think one more.
Okay.
Do you want nothing more than to survive a single alien?
Based on that film, I doubt that I would. But I would, in the safe environment of a computer simulation, I'd give it a shot.
Okay, not in real life.
No.
I don't want to be dealing with the actual xenomorph, but, well... Good thing you answered yes to both those questions, because this game is for you. It's a brand new video game, Alien Isolation. It's being released on October 7th, and according to a review on Blastr.com, it looks as if it really understands what worked about the original Alien movie. It has a sense of dread, minimum alien exposure. You're basically... you only have the one alien, that there's only one alien in this game, and you don't know where it is. So there's your minimal alien exposure and maximum alien impact, as well as a look and feel that pay homage to the 1979 movie. So here's what alien fans should know about the game Alien Isolation. Just a few of the things that you should know. It's a sequel to Alien, not Aliens. All right. It takes place 15 years after the events of Alien and focuses on Ripley's daughter, Amanda Ripley McLaren, as she learns about the events surrounding her mother's disappearance as she makes her way around the seemingly deserted space station. I don't know how to pronounce that. Brad, can you help me out?
I would say it's Sevastopol. Sevastopol. Yep.
Was that an actual thing in the Alien movie?
I'm not sure about that. I know that her having a daughter is canon.
Okay. See, I don't remember that part. Was that mentioned in Alien?
It was. My brain is so freaking scattered today.
That's cool.
I can't remember if it was something that was cut out of. I think it was something that was cut out of the film. It was originally supposed to be a part of it that she did have a child. And this was supposed to be, you know, there and back, and everything was supposed to be cool. And then, you know, they met with the xenomorph, and everything went off the rails. But her daughter is definitely canon.
Okay. All right. So that's one of the things, is basically she's trying to make her way around the space station, looking for evidence as to what happened to her mother. Yes.
Sorry, I got the information. Sevastopol was a large decommissioned trading space station in orbit around 2137, which is the planet from the first Alien film.
Okay, that's right. All right.
So that was because they launched the ship down to the planet, but the space station was.
See, I don't remember a space station in the movie. I just remember.
I'm thinking. Design of blah, 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 Crimea, blah, blah.
That sounds like more of an Aliens thing, that there was a space station in the Aliens movie, not Alien. Okay, you keep
that would make more sense. I'm sorry, this is like horrible radio right now.
No, that's all right.
This dead air. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say that there is evidence that something went on here in the game, which includes a half-chewed body of a synthetic dumped in the corridor, the empty space station filled to the brim with equipment that blends the far future with the 1970s has a nice creepy feel to it. This is according to the person that had a hands-on with the game at the at kind of the unveiling. But even more scaretastic is the alien on board, which is hunting for sweet human meat. The plot isn't the only reason the game is the intellectual descendant of Alien and not Aliens. The game has a lo-fi, sci-fi feel of the first film. In addition, Amanda has to carefully work her way around Sevastopol, just as Ripley did on the Nostromo toward the end of Alien. Yes, even though we think Ripley as one of Hollywood's best gun-toting action heroes in the 1979 movie, she only shot a harpoon gun. And that will lead into the next thing that you should know about this game. In Alien, the weapon of choice for the crew was the flamethrower. In Alien Isolation, we don't even get a pistol. You don't get a gun. You basically have to rely on your wits and stealth and avoid the alien. That's basically what this game is. You are avoiding the xenomorph. You're not trying to, like, hurt it. You're trying to just run away from it. That's what the whole game is. Run away from it and so you don't get killed, basically. There are some tools. You'll get a motion tracker, which they showed in, I believe, Aliens. There were other items laying around, but you could only collect them. In the actual release, you might be able to use them as weapons. That was one of the things that they thought might be different from this release, which is an early release in the actual release to customers version of this game. And the final thing I want to mention about this game is you're not alone. You do have a small ensemble cast that you get to know. One character, Samuels, is a company man. Interestingly, he tells Amanda, "We think we may have found your mother, but as we know from Aliens, Ripley isn't on the Sevastopol." Other characters that we know about are Verlaine and Taylor, both women. And then there's Ricardo, the voice of our comm system, which gives us much-needed guidance, plus there are survivors somewhere in this city-sized space station. So that's what you need to know about Alien Isolation, the game being released on October 7th of this year.
Okay. Now, to pull my head out of my posterior here, yeah, the Sevastopol is something that's completely new.
Okay.
This hasn't been mentioned before. And for some reason, I looked at the number 2137 was this is the year that the game takes place.
Okay.
And somehow thought it was LV-426, which that's the name of the planet that the Nostromo landed on. Completely different.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we got that cleared up. And that name sounded so familiar, though. It's like it should already be in the universe. It sounds like an alien-type name for something.
It really does. You know, even like the name, when you get a name like Weyland-Yutani, I mean, there's different cultural, those names have different cultural connotations to them. And then you get Sevastopol, which is, you know, obviously something from Eastern Europe, probably, you know, Russia, Ukraine, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That just really has that, ties that whole global feel. I mean, and that's what we're seeing now, global economics and whatever. And I thought that was the cool thing about Alien is you had this feeling of corporate conglomeration and that feeling that you definitely see in the second film with what was his name? Burke is the corporate man trying to get, you know, Ripley impregnated and then frozen so they can take a xenomorph back to Earth.
Yep.
And that was really his thing. So
played by Paul Reiser.
Yes, by Paul Reiser.
I saw
that was so weird to see. I mean, this guy who was a comedian in the 80s and a funny man, and all of a sudden he's just this really nasty jerk. It was such a jarring thing, but it works so well.
I saw some screenshots of this game, and it really, really looks like the original 1979 Alien movie. They didn't jazz it up. They didn't make it look more modern. They, you know, they're CRT screens and, you know, vector graphics. It's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, I'm flipping through some of these too. I'm looking at AVPwikia.com.
Okay. That's Alien versus Predator, I'm guessing.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So again, the release date is October 7th of Alien Isolation. And that's the news. Let's move on to Craft Corner. And I still don't have an intro for this, but last week we introduced the new feature, Craft Corner, to kind of replace temporarily, I don't know, maybe permanently, or maybe we'll alternate them from time to time, Craft Corner and Creature Feature. But for right now, we're doing Craft Corner. It's a spotlight of famous spacecrafts from either what people have seen as, you know, Close Encounters or whatever, or we'll take crafts from movies, from fictional aliens. So what do we got this week, Brad? What's your Craft Corner item?
Well, I came really close to using a very famous sci-fi ship, but I thought, yeah, you know what? I'm going to go with the classic.
Okay.
I went with the Flying Saucer,
ship
that we're all incredibly familiar with, especially if you've watched any B sci-fi movies from the 50s. Here we go. Flying saucer, also referred to as a flying disc, is a type of described flying craft with a disc or saucer-shaped body, commonly used generically to refer to any anomalous flying object. It was coined in 1947 and was officially used by the U.S. Air Force in 52 with the broader term unidentified flying object, or UFOs. Early reported sightings of unknown flying saucers usually described them as silver or metallic, sometimes reported as covered with navigation lights or surrounded with a glowing light, hovering or moving rapidly, and either alone or in a formation with other similarly shaped crafts. The disc-shaped flying objects have been interpreted as being sporadically recorded since the Middle Ages.
Wow.
The first highly publicized sighting by Kenneth Arnold in June 24, 1947, resulted in the creation of the exact term by U.S. newspapers. Although Arnold never specifically used the term flying saucer, he was quoted at the time saying that the shape of the objects he saw was like a saucer, disc, or pie plate. And several years later added he had also said the objects moved like saucers skipping across the water.
That was right before – his sighting was right before the Roswell crash, right? That was the month before.
That sounds right.
July 1947 was the Roswell crash, and this is June 1947.
Yeah, that's right. This would have been – yeah, you're absolutely right. Holy cow. Let's see. Arnold's sighting was followed by thousands of similar sightings across the world. Such sightings were once very common, to such an extent that flying saucer was a synonym for UFO through the 60s before it began to fall out of favor. This is a huge article, so I'm going to condense, and we'll have a link to more information on this. Let's see, we're going to skip to a manuscript illustration of the 10th century Japanese narrative. So 10th century, this would be the 900s.
Okay.
The Tale of the Bamboo Cutter depicts a round flying machine similar to a flying saucer.
Wow.
A record of a saucer-shaped object from 1290 of a silver disc flying over a village in Yorkshire. Disc-like flying objects were occasionally reported throughout the millennium. For example, in a mass sighting over Nuremberg in 1561, discs and spheres were reported emerging from large cylinders. They're also claimed by ufologists to frequently show up in religious artwork. Possibly the well-documented instance to specifically compare the objects to saucers and the first to be widely reported was by Kenneth Arnold again, flying near Mount Rainier. That's in Washington State, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, it is.
He reported seeing 9 brightly reflecting vehicles, one shaped like a crescent, but the others more disc or saucer shaped, flying in a echelon formation, weaving like a tail of a kite, flipping and flashing in the sun and traveling with a speed of at least 1,200 miles per hour. Let's see. Immediately following the report, hundreds of sightings of usually saucer-shaped objects were reported across the U.S. and other countries.
He definitely started something.
Yeah, he did.
With the fuse.
Let's see. Yeah, July 8th was Roswell.
Okay.
That same year. Let's see.
You know, I was just thinking about this. You know, maybe the aliens are onto something. Maybe we need to start designing crafts that are saucer shaped. Maybe that's the key to folding space or you know, flying interstellar, going from galaxy to galaxy or you know, from solar system to solar system. Maybe we need to. Maybe the key is a round craft.
Yeah, I remember Neil deGrasse Tyson saying it really doesn't matter what your ship is shaped like. There's no air resistance. You don't have to worry about aerodynamics in space because there's no air.
Yep.
So you could fly a box in space like the Borg.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
As long as you can, you know, as long as it has some kind of, you know, way of pushing it.
Propulsion system.
Yep. Thank you. I couldn't think of that damn word.
You're welcome. My brain seems to slowly start to be starting to become unscattered here. This report is really long, and I grabbed the whole thing, and unfortunately I didn't get a chance to edit it down, but I think that we're going to end with this piece here. The term flying saucer quickly became deeply ingrained in the English vernacular. A Gallup poll from August 1947 found that 90% had heard about the mysterious flying saucers or flying discs, and a 1950 Gallup poll found that 94% of those polled had heard the term, easily beating out all other mentioned commonly used terms in the news such as Cold War, Universal Military Training, and bookie.
Okay.
Think about that.
Yeah.
A Gallup poll, people could automatically go, oh, yeah, I know what a UFO is, but not necessarily know what the Cold War was, and they're right in the middle of it.
What a weird time.
It definitely was. And Project Blue Book was the Air Force project that supposedly documented all of this, and not supposedly, it did. And that ended in 1970. But,
you know, I wonder what happened, because there was a time early on that the U.S. military, the U.S. government was very open to investigating unidentified flying objects. And then all of a sudden they treated it like it was, you know, they tried to cover it up as much as they could. I wonder what happened. Like, if somebody came in and said, you know, we can't sound like we're crazy. You know, Americans aren't going to believe us. Or what else happened? What else could have happened?
You know, I think some of it, and, you know, this is conjecture on my part, but some of the quote-unquote UFO sightings were supposedly, you know, like stealth craft used for spying purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And for as much, I mean, look at the amount of spying we're doing now on our own citizenry and around the world with drones and everything. With the amount of information that we have access to with the internet, I think you really kind of have to keep a distance from it and not necessarily give the view that you're looking into this if you actually know what it is. You know what I'm saying? They can't acknowledge that, yep, we got a new stealth craft out there, or, yeah, you saw this thing and they just need to ignore it now.
Yeah.
That's got to be the way to go, because if they make any moves to investigate it with the internet and, you know, everything else that we have going on right now, the possibility of maybe having that information leaked or somebody, you know, following the patterns of people investigating things, they'll figure things out. And, you know, I don't know. It just, we become so secretive as a society now, or try to be, to try to keep secrets. I don't know. It kind of makes sense, even though we were, that almost didn't make sense at all.
No,
what I'm trying to say is,
we understand, Brad.
Because we have access to so much information, I think that they need to obscure it as much as possible and not investigate or make the appearance of it, because at some point in time, somebody's going to spill the beans.
Yeah. It seemed like it was early on, though, like maybe mid-1950s to early 1960s, that the government changed their tune when it came to investigating UFOs. At first, they were very serious and took people serious, and then after a certain point, they're like, well, we're not going to admit anything, and we're not going to take this stuff seriously anymore. That's the stuff that I've read, at least, the vibe
of that. Yeah, at first, you know, I'm looking at this here, and I remember watching a documentary. The first project was Project Sign, and that went on. That was the first public Air Force study. And then it morphed into Project Grudge, where they wanted to not acknowledge anything or say that, yeah, we'll look into it, and they never did.
They're like, that's the Grudge.
Yeah. and then in 52, it went back to – it became Project Blue Book. And it's kind of seemed to be a combination of the two approaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll look into it, but we're not going to do that much with the information.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Brad. Great craft corner item this week. And we'll put the pattern for this craft on the show notes, that you can make your very own flying saucer from Craft Corner and put it on Pinterest. All right. Let's move on from Craft Corner to our picks this week. My pick is... this is very unlike me. This is very uncharacteristically Dave, but I picked something. I picked an animated TV show this week. It's Ultimate Spider-Man. Are you familiar with Ultimate Spider-Man, the animated series?
A little bit.
Okay.
I haven't really watched it. But...
Okay. Well, it was neat to watch, but I don't think I'm going to watch it any more of it, because it's really silly. The Spider-Man character and Peter Parker in this, and just the whole presentation of it, seems very silly. But the episode that I picked was from season 1, episode 19, titled Homesick Hulk, which aired on September 9th, 2012. So here's a brief synopsis of Homesick Hulk, Ultimate Spider-Man. Hulk smashes back into Spider-Man's life where he is sick with an alien infection caused by the Phalanx. Do you know what the Phalanx is, Mr. Comic Book Guy? Is that a thing from the Marvel Universe?
Yeah, it is. I want to say it was Cameron Hodge. No.
Well, I can tell you what they look like and what they appeared to be. They appeared to be alien, metal alien creatures.
They're techno-organic beings.
Yeah.
That's right. The Phalanx is a yeah. That's from New Mutants. Crap.
They could take any organic substance and basically morph themselves into it, sort of. That's what I got from this episode, at least.
Yeah. Oh my god.
This is the episode where Brad
this
totally
is the
loses
episode
his mind.
Where just my brain is completely freaking useless. You should scoop it out of my skull because I'm rambly and I got nothing.
No, this is entertaining. This is good. This is good stuff.
I'm glad you're entertained.
I'm not making fun of you. I'm just saying this is, you know, it's showing that you are a real human, Brad. We're seeing the human side of Brad Ledwig tonight. So okay, I'm gonna run down more Okay, so what happened was Spider-Man found Hulk after he saw the spacecraft crash in New York City. It opened up because the Hulk was inside it, so he basically smashed it open. He found the Hulk, and fearing that S.H.I.E.L.D. would want to lock the Hulk away rather than help him, Spider-Man sees no choice but to take Hulk home and keep him hidden from Aunt May while protecting him from the Phalanx and the Fury, as in Nick Fury. See, Nick Fury is in this episode. In Ultimate Spider-Man, Spider-Man's working for S.H.I.E.L.D., which I wish it was in the movie universe, but that's not possible with all the movie rights. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Not going to happen.
Yeah.
Warlock was the name of the character. He was the first techno-organic being from the Technarchy that eventually went down the road as people were writing things. They eventually created the Phalanx as a part of the people that this character came from, the race that he came from.
So in this episode, the whole bit is Peter Parker / Spider-Man has to hide Hulk from Aunt May and Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. So Hulk is at first in his room, in Peter Parker's room. He's making too much noise. He's breaking things. Things are being broken. So he sneaks him down to the basement where he can cause less damage. And one of the things that he has to do is give Aunt May some headphones and a blindfold because she, like, hurt her ankle, like, mountain climbing or something like that. She came back early from her trip mountain climbing because she hurt herself. So Peter Parker gives her the blindfold and the headphones to mask her from hearing the Hulk upstairs and then in the basement. And then they go out and they have to fight the Phalanx in some, like, some warehouse or something. And then Nick Fury eventually shows up and explains, or Peter Parker explains that the Hulk isn't bad, and S.H.I.E.L.D. takes the Hulk, and he starts working for S.H.I.E.L.D. at that point. That's the episode. It's really silly. This is the silliest Spider-Man that I've seen outside of the 1980s live-action TV series.
Interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, if you want some silliness in your Spider-Man, first season's available on Netflix, and that's where I watched it. So that's my pick.
There you go.
All right. Let's move on to you, my friend. What did you watch, listen to, read this week?
Well, speaking of which, Spider-Man and aliens, I dug way back for this one.
Brad, but before you continue, I totally forgot to mention the reason I had Spider-Man as a pick because The Amazing Spider-Man opens in theaters this weekend.
Ah, that's right. Yes, it does.
Yes.
I think Alex and I might be going to see that this weekend. It's free comic book day, actually, on Saturday.
Yep. Another reason why I picked it. Comic book movie, comic book character. There you go.
Boom. And my pick was something that is Spider-Man based as well. Secret Wars issue number 8. Secret Wars was an 8-issue. Was it 8 issues? Oh my god, my brain is just. It was a 12-issue. Sorry. I'm sorry. The first. Oh my god, my brain.
Thank God for the internet. That's all I'm gonna say.
Because I'm like clicking around. I'm going. It was. Oh, I need to be beaten. Now I got everything jumbled up in my head completely at this point. So at the Secret Wars number 8 was the issue where, well, let me describe. Secret Wars was a way for Marvel to get all of their characters, all of them, into a miniseries where they ended up fighting on this battle planet, essentially. And this alien being known as the Beyonder wanted to try to understand heroes, understand villains, understand humanity. And he grabbed all the heroes, all the villains, and created this battle planet. And everybody fought, and they died, and they come back to life, and all this stuff happened. It was just, it was insane. And at the end of this, Peter Parker was just like, you know, hey, I want to get something for my trouble here. Because, of course, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting this there's a machine there, and this beam of light forms a black sort of a sphere, a small black sphere in his hand. And the sphere ends up enveloping his hand and then enveloping his body, and all of a sudden he's got an instant changing black and white costume.
I know where this goes. I know where this goes.
And it was a cool thing for Peter Parker, because now he could wear his regular clothes. He didn't have to stop to change his outfit, but now he was a black and white looking hero. So it didn't really look anything like he used to.
Oh, this is not Venom. This is not the start of Venom. This is something different.
No, this is the start of Venom.
Oh, it is. Okay.
We come to find out later on that this is an alien symbiote that ends up, you know, pairing up with a creature and actually can form a skin around it and actually enhance their fighting abilities and whatnot. So we end up finding, and this kind of goes on. This is our introduction. Secret Wars number 8 is our introduction to this symbiote creature. We don't know it yet, but this is the creation, the first time that this thing appears. And then as time goes on, he ends up working with the Fantastic Four, and Mr. Fantastic finds a way to separate him from the costume because things are not going well for Peter and this creature. This thing is starting to actually start to do things on its own without Peter.
Okay.
And it has a hold on him. So we end up finding, Mr. Fantastic, Reed Richards, ends up finding out that it is weakened by psionics, by incredibly loud sounds. And that's how he ends up separating this alien creature, this alien symbiote from Peter Parker. And because it's a symbiote, a parasite, it needs to be connected to something to live. So it limps off. It disappears. And it ends up bonding with Peter Parker's rival, another photographer, who's not a very, very particularly good man.
Okay.
And they end up bonding. And Eddie Brock, this rival photographer, ends up being the new host of the symbiote. And it feeds on Eddie Brock's hatred of Peter Parker and begins to kind of change Eddie Brock a bit too. So as time goes on, there's more stories with this symbiote, and it has a baby, and it just all sorts of strange stuff happens. But our first introduction is Secret Wars number 8.
And that's
why I picked it.
Okay, that was published like back in the 80s, right? Late 80s?
Yeah, it would have been 85.
Okay.
Is when number 8 would have come out.
Because I remember seeing Venom, or not Venom, but I remember seeing the Black Spider-Man for the first time back when I was in high school.
Yeah, and actually, I think it was soon after the Secret Wars series came out, they introduced a new comic book called Web of Spider-Man. And if you wanted to see him in his black costume, that was the comic that you read. The other Spider-Man, well, for a little bit, I thought he was still in kind of the red and blue a little bit. But then it ended up kind of getting into everything, and it was a weird time.
Yeah.
It was a weird time.
On a Spider-Man note, two things that I heard about The Amazing Spider-Man and a reason why you should stay after during the credits at the end of The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is there's a mid-credits thing for X-Men, Days of Future Past, because apparently the two movies are connected somehow. I mean, they're both Marvel properties, right?
They are Marvel properties.
But they're not, I know they're not, it's not Marvel Productions. It's, what, Universal
no,
or Sony?
I want to, yeah, Sony is Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say 20th Century Fox is X-Men.
Okay, but there's some kind of connection between The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and the new X-Men movie. It's the mid-credit, you have to stick around to see it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll have to have a report on that next week.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is have your Shazam ready, because on a certain song, you turn on your Shazam app, and it'll give you a link to the first look at the Sinister Six movie that they're going to make. Not a fan of that?
It makes me sad. You know, the one thing that really works so well for Marvel Studios is even though they don't have Spider-Man, even though they don't have the Fantastic Four, and even though they don't have the X-Men, and all the characters that come with that, which are considered their A-string characters, Marvel Studios has a rich, what most considered a B-team universe. The thing that you have now with Sony having Spider-Man and the characters that they have is it feels like they're desperate to create a whole franchise off of this.
Yep, everybody's trying to do this. They're trying to do this with DC, you know, with the whole Man of Steel, Batman versus Superman, and then
they're going to do the Justice League.
Justice League,
movie,
yeah.
And...
Yep, yep.
They, well.
Franchises, my friend. Franchise.
Yeah. And it makes sense for like DC because they've got a large basket of characters to pull from. But if you've just got Spider-Man and the characters that, you know, the bad guys, and you've probably got Black Cat in there and some other characters, it seems like a more limited palette than what Marvel Studios has access to. And the only reason why I'm not even mentioning the DC, the Time Warner, because they can't get their act together at all.
Yeah.
They
got it.
Yeah.
They got they're betting all their stuff on Zack Snyder to see if he can pull this off.
Yeah, and I just read something today that they're looking to have Zack direct like all mm-hmm. of the DC movies.
Yeah, he's their guy. He's their man.
And it just, there's got to be a point where a director goes, no more.
Yeah,
I can't imagine him doing. I'm just really sad that they haven't done a Wonder Woman movie yet. That's ridiculous.
That's part of it. That's part of the plan. They're gonna do Batman versus Superman, Justice League, and then the Wonder Woman movie. That's what I read at least.
Yeah, I'm just I can't believe that. As soon as they mentioned that they were gonna do a Batman versus Superman movie, I'm like, why? It doesn't, you know, develop them separately, make, you know, they've got rich characters and worlds all their own, and then eventually, that was a smart thing that Marvel did. They didn't immediately hook everybody up together, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Not right off the bat. I mean,
yeah,
Avengers was sort of a pipe dream that they had, and then as they did a couple of movies, they went, oh, hey, and they started to tie things together.
Yeah, DC is playing catch up. They're like, holy crap, we got to get our stuff together. Let's do this thing. That's basically, I think, what their frame of mind is right now.
Yeah, and yeah. Marvel Studios being a young upstart, I mean, they're babies compared to, you know, to Warner Brothers. It's mind-numbing to me that this young upstart company can make them look so old and antiquated and irrelevant when it comes to to superhero movies.
It's like SpaceX, you know, kicking the ass of every other aerospace company in the world. You know, it's like, we can do this faster, we're stronger, we're better, we can do it cheaper. You know, it's,
and I think that comes down to baggage, really. You know, seeing that Elon Musk is suing the federal government because they didn't get even a chance to bid for the new set of projects that they're, you know, spy satellites.
Yep.
They didn't even get a chance to bid. And the only thing that's holding them back from some of, you know, them being able to do this is paperwork.
Yep.
The paperwork is taking so damn long to get processed that nothing's happening.
Yep.
And, you know, it almost, in a certain way, it looked like, and I'm going to draw a parallel here, is you have the old guard that's well established, and there's a unspoken or spoken bureaucracy that kind of comes around it that really bogs down everything.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why a young upstart company like Marvel Studios could come in and go, bam, and show everybody up, because they don't have all that back scratching and, you know, palm greasing that older, more established companies have to do. And that's just, that's sad for us, the consumers, and those people that are interested in those types of films. It serves no purpose.
Thank you, Brad. That was great.
For that comic book diatribe.
Yes.
You're absolutely welcome.
Thanks for listening.
Nelson.
Thanks for listening to our beta episode of Comic Book Talk here on the Galactic Netcast Network.
This has been Comic Talk.
Hey, we do need to get out of here, but leave us feedback, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. galacticnetcasts@gmail.com is our email address. The voicemail number is 805-328-3966. Again, we encourage you to give $1 a month to our Patreon campaign, patreon.com/galacticnetcast. I know I'm throwing a bunch of stuff at you guys, but you can find it all at our website, galacticnetcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review and 5 stars on iTunes. We appreciate that. That's going to do it for this Alien Invasion, number 103. Thanks for joining us. Final thought, Brad. What do you got?
Cricket, 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 cricket.
That can be your final thought.
Something. I had something for a brief second. Oh, it was terrible. Now it's gone. Everything's gone, Dave Nelson. It's all left my head.
Brad wants a brain.
I really do. If an alien has a brain that can just, you know, leave on my doorstep or something that I can cram into my head, that would be awesome, because the one I have is expired like bad cheese.
Okay. That's perfect. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and we will talk to you next week.
Sounds good, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Leave your hailing frequencies open and scanners on full, because another Galactic Netcast will be approaching your coordinates soon. For more information, go to galacticnetcasts.com.